The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ArfCom do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ArfCom, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ArfCom, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love to stick a battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ArfCom starts now.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's now time for your Radio Free ArfCom. This is your show. My name's Benjamin, but I'm just the guy behind the mic hosting. So feel free to make it your show by calling us at 415-762-1161. Or you can IM me on ArfCom, and if I can see it, I will get it. It's FL_flyfishing_guide. And I'd love for you to share your thoughts and comments with us here at ArfCom Radio. Let's get started. This week, and from here on out, I plan on beginning the show by addressing your comments and criticisms about me, the previous week's shows, the guests, as well as any issues you, the audience, brings to my attention. A couple people had some questions last week about me. Again, this is Benjamin, your new host, taking over for John. I got to admit, last week was my first show, and last week was a very tough week for me to start the show due to some interesting, rather personal issues. But I do appreciate all the positive comments on the first show, and let's move on from there. We did have a couple comments here, and I'm going to go ahead and pull up these IMs that some people have sent me regarding last week's show and read them to you, and we will go from there. The first one is from a member named Cormorant Slayer. Hey, Ben, show was better than I could have done. It's like everything else. People get used to hearing or seeing things in a certain way, and when it changes, they get fired up about it. So thank you for that positive message. Got another one here from DPMM. Hey, Ben, are you going to start keep opening the show with Joe? Yeah, we do plan on having Joe DeBregalis here again tonight, and as long as he'd like to be a guest, we'd be happy to have him. Another message we got here is from a member named Heavily Armed. He asked for some opinions, if I'd be willing to take criticism, and I said sure. So here's some of the things that he said. He said, the best part of ArfCom is the tech forums. I encourage you to devote more time to talking gear or competition shooting and a little bit less time on politics. There are already a bunch of excellent hosts who talk politics, but fewer talking about the latest optics or free float rail systems or other tactical gear. Also, again, he said that my sound was a little bit not all there. And I will admit that I wasn't in a exactly positive state of mind for the first show. So I'm trying to be a little bit more lighthearted and lively for you guys here today. And I will try to do my best. But I do agree wholeheartedly that I certainly can't do the job that Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh or any of those guys have with their radio program. So we're going to try to keep the focus on the Second Amendment and keep it focused on, obviously, the weapons platforms and the new things in the industry as far as you know, weapons, lights, optics, technical, tactical, competition shooting, and all that fun stuff. This was the Independence Day weekend. I hope everybody got out and did something patriotic. I know I went out and took my shotgun and did some skeet shooting on Saturday, which was a blast, and then shot my best score, as a matter of fact. Sunday, we had a little barbecue with the friends and relatives, as I'm sure many of you did. And I think one of the things that's important right now as an American and as a consider myself a patriot is to really remember what this Independence Day was all about. And I love the hot dogs and beer and burgers and family and friends and summertime sunshine just as much as, if not more than anybody else. But I do want to make sure that we remember why it is that we're celebrating, and to me it's one of my favorite holidays, not just because of it's, you know, a day off for a lot of people, but because it is the real celebration of the birth of this country, and this country and the things and the principles that it was founded upon are the reasons that we're free and the reason why we do still have the best and greatest country in the world. With that in mind, I want to do a little bit of a patriotic thing here for you listeners. And I just want to do a little bit of a reading from the Declaration of Independence. I think it's the document that got us here, and I think it's something that should at least be read on a yearly basis on America's birthday. But, you know, it's a good thing to have a copy of this document in your house. You know, you can pick up this book here. It's the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, published by Bantam Classic. And this book cost me $2.95. I've had it a couple years, and I don't think for a document as important and as well-respected and well-regarded and something that gave birth to our nation, it's not a lot of money to lay out to have in your house and put in your hands and, you know, really sit down and take the time to read what this country was all about. I'm going to just read you the first two paragraphs, the opening, and I'm going to skip through the list of grievances directed towards Britain because I don't necessarily know that reading every single one of them at this point, I mean, it's something you guys can follow up on if you really want to see the grievances. But I will read you the first two paragraphs, and then I'm going to skip forward and read the last paragraph. And here begins the Declaration of Independence in honor of our nation's founding. This is the action of the Second Continental Congress, July 4th, 1776, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. End quote. And folks, those are the intro that many of us know and love to hear and love to read. I'm going to go ahead and the editor of this book is Pauline Meyer, and she has a very nice intro regarding the Declaration of Independence, and you know, she talks about some of the history of it. And one of the things that she cites here is she says that, quote, the first copies of Thomas Paine's Common Sense appeared on January 9th, 1776, then spread like wildfire through the country. There was no going back, the pamphlet argued. American freedom could never be secure under the British crown, unquote. And she goes on to say that it's, you know, they needed to separate, and then once Thomas Paine's Common Sense was out, I mean, that was it. And if you read some of the things that Thomas Paine talks about, the book is wonderful if you've never read Common Sense. It's, again, a very patriotic read. It takes you through a lot of the history, and particularly what the mindset of the, you know, revolutionary-type America was thinking. One paragraph out of Thomas Paine's Common Sense here is, he says, "I challenge the warmest advocate for reconciliation to show a single advantage that this continent can reap by being connected with Great Britain. I repeat the challenge. Not a single advantage is derived." And then he goes on to state an example. "Our corn will fetch its price in any market in Europe, and our imported goods must be paid for, buy them where we will." Unquote. He goes on to explain that there's many more disadvantages and injuries that could be potentially forthcoming if they were to maintain their alliance with, or dependence, I should say, on Great Britain, and, you know, trades being involved in European conflicts and wars, and so on and so forth. So I hope you guys enjoyed that little bit of patriotic reading there. I certainly do, and I take the opportunity to try and get a real glimpse of what was going on in our nation's founders' brains as they were constructing all these wonderful documents that today, a lot of the things in it, you know, we tend to take for granted as far as our freedoms go, and we need to be constantly vigilant of all those freedoms in order to, you know, maintain them. You know, a freedom that doesn't get exercised is a freedom lost, and we need to all remember that for the not just Independence Day, but every day of our lives, and let's remember to remind our friends and family and our coworkers and the people that we see on a daily basis that it is important to know and read and study these founding documents, because this is, you know, it's right out of the horse's mouth, as they say. I mean, these people wrote it. It's something that you can read and you can learn from a history book, but I think you'll really gain a lot more depth of knowledge and insight into actually reading the father's words as opposed to just reading about them. So that's my little patriotic contribution for the in honor of Independence Day. I hope you enjoyed it. Moving on, I just got the new issue of Guns and Ammo magazine in my hand. One of their news in brief that I think is important to share is the National Shooting Sports Foundation has launched an online campaign offering free educational videos about firearm safety and wildlife conservation to teachers and school administrators. The Firearm Safety DVD contains three segments, two designed for viewing by students in various grade levels, and one for a general audience. They go on to say that more than 100,000 schools across the country have received the NSSF's educational videos. These are teaching students how to respond, very similar to the NRA's Eddie Eagle program. If you see a firearm, don't touch it, and so on and so forth, to try to keep our youngsters safe without injecting any of the volatile firearm politics into the mix. It's just a good gun safety. I'm sure if you wanted a copy of that DVD for your school or for your students, you should just go and visit the NSSF organization. Moving on, one of the more interesting things in this Guns and Ammo magazine is on page 38. We've got a picture of an AR-15 with a wood stock and pistol grip on it. So that's something to consider, I suppose. If you're not one of the ones that likes the black rifle, I suppose it's all customization is potentially available. So there you have a wood-stocked AR. Didn't think I'd be seeing one of those anytime soon. They do have a review of the new XDM 45 pistol. I actually ordered one of these for the gun store that I work in. Got it in the shop the other day. I got to put my hands on it a little bit. It's a nice feeling gun. I'm sure, you know, apparently when our guest last week, Reed, was telling us about, you know, very in-demand guns, and when he told me that he had this firearm for the store, I jumped right on it because he said the demand for them was absolutely crazy. It's like I said, Total Package by Patrick Sweeney on page 52. He goes on to discuss some of the things about the XDM. The first glance, it is a 13+1 45 ACP cartridge. It's got a stainless steel barrel that says here has a melanite treatment that makes it harder. I've just highlighted a few things. He says the pistol grip on it is relatively larger than a typical single stack. They did enlarge the frame for the 45 compared to the 9mm, but he says it also feels smaller than the existing XD and 45 ACP. He goes on to continue that the existing XD magazines will fit in the XD. And it has a 4.5-inch barrel to make a better carry gun. So here's a pretty nice write-up. I don't know, Pat Sweeney is one of my favorite gun writers. He seems to have a very in-depth knowledge and done a lot of shooting. And the gun itself does come with a nice hard case, spare mags, belt holder, holster, and the pistol itself, as well as the gun lock. We noticed in when we got it in the store, the packaging itself was very solid. A very nice presentation in all the XD line. I personally don't own any Springfield XDs, but I've certainly put my hands on plenty of them, and they do make a nice gun. So if that's something that you're interested in, visit your local gun store, support us little guys, and get out there and check out one of the new XDMs and see how they shoot. One of the interesting articles here in this Guns and Ammo magazine that I sort of was taking an interest to is Boddington's article on how far is too far for hunting. I know that particularly with the black rifles, you know, that we're getting a lot more hunters out there. You know, like I said before, I hunt, you know, I hog hunt with my AR-15, and, you know, many people think traditionally that your bolt action type rifles are going to be your long range stuff. Boddington goes on to say that the biggest difference between snipering and hunting is that in military sniping, in his opinion, he says any hit counts, whereas as us hunters, we want to be able to cleanly and humanely take our game without wounding animals and following the basic rules of firearm safety in terms of knowing where our shots are going to go, what's behind our target, and so on and so forth. Boddington goes on to say that his position is, quote, that there is a point at which shooting at game is irresponsible and unethical, unquote. He continues, he says, conditions matter a great deal. His opinion is that shooting at animals at about 500 yards rapidly becomes unsportsmanlike. The choice, he obviously says, he leaves it up to the personal, the individual. However, he says there are an awful lot of reasonably competent riflemen who have no business shooting much past 250 yards no matter what the condition. It's all the rest of the stuff, bullet performance, ability to call the shot, difficulty in properly following up, that causes an unacceptably high risk of wounding and losing game, unquote. I typically tend to agree with that. It is not easy for most people to shoot long range, and me, I do like to hunt. I really enjoy it, but I don't fiend for it so much that I feel like I have to go out there and kill something every time just to, you know, put meat on the table. I mean, I'm not starving. I don't need to hunt to get food, you know, and I personally would rather get a humane, you know, clean kill or pass up on the shot rather than potentially wound even a feral animal like a hog or something along those lines. So your opinions on what I've just gone over would be really appreciated. If you guys want to comment, if you got any hunters out there that would like to talk about what type of ranges they feel comfortable with hunting, you can give us a call here on the show at 415-762-1161. And again, this is Benjamin. I'd really like to hear from the listeners out there. Like I said before, we were talking about freedom, obviously the freedom that we all know and love that binds us as a group and as a community here at AR15.com is the Second Amendment freedom that was, you know, as we've been discussing, was a natural human right of self-defense and protection. And the Second Amendment doesn't grant that right to us. It prevents the government from taking it from us. At least that's the idea. With that in mind, again, we have a very special guest, Joe DeBurgalis from the NRA, one of our regular contributors, and he's on the line to discuss some of the recent updates. And we're now obviously a week out from the McDonald case, and it's had a little bit of time to breathe, and let's see where we're going to go from here. Hey, Joe, how are you doing today, sir?
Hi, Ben. How are you, my friend?
Sitting here in the rainy South Florida on the line with my good friend from the NRA.
Well, I tell you, my friend, it's a balmy 95 degrees here in sunny Buffalo, New York, so I feel for you.
Excellent. I was talking to you before. We were sort of looking at the Guns and Ammo article here that Chris Cox wrote, and he says that there's some states that have bills pending to restrict and regulate gun shows, more states potentially implementing semi-auto bans or expanding bans they have, you know, one gun a month laws. I read somewhere that Chicago potentially is pushing a one gun per person per residence, and sort of wanted to see where we're standing in fighting the good fight for these potential issues nationwide.
Well, there's a wide variety of issue type of legislation pending in a variety of state houses throughout the country. The NRA, through its Institute for Legislative Action, the Standing Point, we have liaisons in each state, if you don't know that, Ben, that when the legislation is in session, or legislatures are in session, they're out there and they're on a daily basis in contact with that individual state, their minority, majority leaders, and all the individual legislators. So not having the article in front of me, I know Chris is constantly looking out, kind of putting out an alert network to see what's out there and trying to engage our membership, become more interested in the topic to kind of allow us, the NRA, all the rest of the pro-gun organizations out there, the NRA-backed state affiliates, so we know what to do, what's going on, get a little intel, and make sure that we're well-armed when it comes to these legislations being clocked in. So we're out there. There's a variety of things. Chicago Mayor Daley, in clear defiance of the Supreme Court ruling, is doing everything he can to try to put obstacles in the way of the ruling. This is similar to what happened in D.C. after the Heller decision. The various obstacles will fall again because they're going to be challenged in court. And I just ask a little patience and due deference to my dear friend Dan, who I know is listening. The smoke is still coming from the barrel on this one, so we need to let that clear out a little bit to see what's going to drop and how we attack it. So that's where we are in the good city of Chicago. There's a variety of different things. I invite everybody to go to www.nraila.org, and there's a search engine there. You can put your particular state in, and you'll get an update of where we are. Majority, with the exception of New York, of the state houses are now in recess, and they're out there, depending on their election cycles, either campaigning for November, or they're going to reconvene sometime later in their legislative session, probably, I would suspect, September, October, when most of the houses come back. So we're kind of in a reprieve now. But the one thing we can do is make sure we listen to Radio Free ARFCOM, make sure we go through all the threads there on ARFCOM, a lot of great information out there. And I would suggest going to, which I believe is the best compilation of all the laws in the country that are pending against our freedom, www.nraila.org.
Excellent. Why is it that these cities continually push for this legislation, or they continually try to fight the Supreme Court rulings? Where in their mindset are they coming up with this stuff that they? I mean, is it just a power grab? Do you think, or are they that deluded in their own belief system that they think they can just outright rule over their little fiefdoms?
Well, I think it's a combination of all that. I believe it's these legislatures, from town councils to city corporations to a variety of different, you know, city manager, city management type of types of government out there, Ben, that they have to, they want to chime in on things they have no control over. I mean, the latest thing is down on the border in Arizona, where you have a variety of town councils either being pro, which of course I'm a firm believer in what Governor Brewer is doing down there, although I'm supporting Buzz Mills for governor. But it's one of these things where you're having these small towns take a position on that. A lot of times they want to sit there and believe for their own political good that they can do something for their own town that pretty much goes to their own bias. Instead of reading what the Constitution is about, they want to infuse their own bias, be it right or be it wrong. I mean, look no further than what happens in San Francisco or some of the other liberal bastions of the nation. No matter what happens, they always feel that they've got a better thought process.
Right, and in regards to this specific thing, I just kind of want to get your opinion on it, whether that be from you or from, you know, but more of a personal opinion about, to me, this whole thing about whatever, if it's a rumor, whether it's they're trying to make it a law, whatever it is, but this whole thing about Chicago, they're putting one gun per person per residence, that to me, they seem to be taking the Supreme Court ruling saying that you are allowed to own a handgun and interpreting it as you are allowed to own a handgun. What's your take on that? I mean, isn't that infringement?
Well, it could be, Ben. It's all interpretation, and I think the attorneys are going to have a field day with it. What Daley's doing is trying to circumvent what Alito alluded to in his writings concerning the decision. Right now, it says in there, and we still have to go through and dissect, like I said, the smoke's got to clear the barrel a little bit, that anybody can hold a handgun or possess a handgun in their home. What happens when they step outside the door? So I think what they're trying to do is say you can only have one. Now, these types of schemes have been proposed, some have passed throughout the country. Well, many of them have failed, and they'll be challenged. You're going to see a lot of these things. Remember, you can sit there and post up whatever you would like to as a proposal for passage. It's a matter if it's passed, and then it's got to be laid across the scales of constitutionality. So they may put forward, they may be successful there, but it'll be challenged. It's more of a delay tactic, in my belief.
They think that they can either outspend or outweigh potentially the people who would look to bring lawsuits against this legislation or whatever ordinances they decide to pass?
I believe that being the case, Ben. I mean, you look at Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which is funded by Bloomberg. Daley's one of the major participants in that movement. As I mentioned before, Mayors Against Illegal Guns is far outpacing that of the Brady campaign and becoming the premier anti-gun organization in this country. I would invite the listeners to go to their website, see if their mayor or elected official is participating, because all it is another form of anti-freedom, anti-gun type of organization out there. But that's what he's trying to do. It's a delay tactic. He's trying to put it in there. He's trying to say, okay, I can rule my city better than you can. And obviously, you can see from what outline to the total ban, Morton Grove in Illinois and a variety of in the city there itself, there's still crime. As a law enforcement officer myself, I'm telling you right now, gun bans don't work. And if you look around the country, those cities that have the most restrictive gun laws have the highest murder rates per capita. Make no mistake about it. Because the citizens are going to follow the law. A criminal, by definition, is one who's going to break it. So you can pass all the laws in the world. They're not going to do anything in order to stem the flow of violence. I'm a firm believer that the citizen, and being a citizen of this country, you have the right to self-defense. And if that's of your choosing, be it a firearm, be it a baseball bat, or be it whatever you'd like. Your house is your castle. So it's one of these things where the nanny state syndrome kind of belief out there, Ben, that we can do it for you, that's where I believe Mayor Daley is coming from.
And that seems to me to be antithetical to the whole culture of freedom that we just described in the Declaration of Independence when we were reading through it. That, you know, the mindset was, let's take care of ourselves. By doing that, we'll go ahead and make the country a better place. Not, you know, they were revolting from an overbearing government. Clearly, it kind of amazes me that you what you just mentioned about the Mayors Against Illegal Guns going outpacing the Brady Bunch, given their activity. I don't know. I suppose they've been relatively, you know, fading into the background. We hope lately, except for in the media stories, that they, you know, and clearly always are pushing. You know, there's always the Brady representative whenever you hear a news story that even, you know, somewhat involves a gun or a firearm. But, you know, particularly, you know, here in Florida, where it was one of the first states with the shall issue carry laws, and that, like anything else, you know, they predicted, you know, blood in the streets and whatever, and that was in the 1980s, and still hasn't happened. It's been on, put, you know, basically 25 years since, you know, the concealed carry laws were given. And, you know, Florida, you know, they call it the gunshine state for a reason, because I can tell you from being in my perspective, I mean, we certify an awful lot of people for concealed carry, and we sell an awful lot of concealed carry handguns. And, you know, as long as, you know, we typically have relatively responsible customers, you know, we typically are able to better, for lack of a better term, screen our customers to where we know that when we have a customer coming in, we know that by the time they leave, they're going to be educated and they're going to be hopefully a responsible gun owner, NRA member, and firearm aficionado. Whereas, you know, and I think that helps a lot because of the culture of the NRA and the culture that teaches responsible gun ownership. And as long as we continue that and try to go out there and make sure people are being responsible gun owners, then you're never going to see blood in the streets. And the only potential blood that you are going to see in the streets is the dumb criminal that's trying to rob you, knowing that you're in a concealed carry state.
Oh, most definitely, Ben. I have a home down in Florida, so I'll say we. We're very fortunate down there in Florida to have an advocate and former NRA president, Marion Hammer. She's out there constantly. She's a very dynamic grandmother, and she's constantly in the Florida State House passing rights that advocate our freedom in Florida. Now, every place that has gone to our side, which has struck down the bans, which has allowed its citizenry to make its own decision whether they're going to be armed, have seen a reduction in crime. Look no further than the Armed Citizen columns in the NRA magazine of your choice. You can go online, you can take a look at all those. This is where a properly licensed or permitted, up here in New York, they have to be permitted. Various states don't have to be, and I understand that. But as long as you have and you're legally allowed to carry a firearm, there have been hundreds of thousands of recorded and documented cases where just the sight of the firearm has caused, has stopped the crime in steps. And there's been other cases, thankfully, that a citizen who's been armed and took the time to make sure they know how to handle it, whatever platform, whatever weapon they're carrying or firearm, has stopped the robbery in progress, the sexual assault in progress. So that's what it's all about. It's definitely a deterrent. I believe if someone wants to carry, to make sure they know how to use that in a stressful situation. There's a variety of us out there who carry all sorts of different defensive tools, if you will, from either a Coubertin or to maybe a pepper spray or a mace to a set of car keys to a variety of things that people carry, a knife. Just make sure you know what you're doing with it. Because in a stressful situation, if you can't do it when you're normal and you're in a non-stress or pressure situation, it's going to fall right to heck when you have to use it in a stressful situation. That's just common sense.
Yeah, that's
what's wrong with
things,
that?
Right?
So I'm just going to tread on your rights. You have the right in this country to defend yourself and that of your family.
Yes, sir, and we totally agree with you on that one. We always say, and we talked about it a little briefly last week in terms of getting the training necessary, and one of the things you know, particularly that we enjoy in our, you know, relationship as a gun store with, you know, with the NRA is being able to train people and educate people. And it's amazing when, you know, there's an awful lot of customers and clientele that come in looking for new, you know, looking for a firearm, or they might have been in the service, you know, 20 or 30 years ago and haven't shot or fired a gun since, and they're beginning to realize that now is the time to not only exercise their freedoms, but also exercise their rights, and that, and take their personal responsibility for putting their safety into their own hands, rather than hoping and praying that either something bad is never going to happen, you know, the whole, you know, sticking your head in the sand, or hoping that the police are going to get there in time. So that's certainly something to consider for most of us. But luckily, you know, like I said, on this program, we do have the benefit of most, if not all of us, are, you know, firearm owners. But as we were speaking before, I think it's incumbent upon us to be responsible and to educate our fellow gun owners, make sure we're all being safe out there, make sure we educate those who may not be familiar with firearms, and we all have to be the ambassadors to not only our sports, but also our rights as well. I'll give you the last word here, Mr. Joe, and then we're going to go on a quick little break.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, I'm in firm agreement with you, Ben. I think, and majority of people I've met through ARFCOM feel that it's exactly the same way as you and I. They're tacticians. They yearn to learn new techniques. They make sure they know how to handle whatever they're carrying. And the brotherhood there is unbelievable. There's a great bunch of patriots out there. I'll leave you with this, Ben. There's another weapon we have, or weapons, I should say, that we have are just as powerful as the handgun or the rifle or the shotgun. And that's the pen or pencil that we use to write our elected officials, the internet, the computer we have, to send emails, or to telephone to contact them. Because that's where all this stuff will stop. If our voices are heard, majority of the things we talk about, put me out of a job, guys, the majority of things we talk about will end once we get these obstructive and obtrusive bits of legislation that stand in our way of freedom, either vetoed or knocked down, or better yet, not even proposed.
Yes, sir. And, Joe, we really do appreciate it. Again, Joe DeBergales from the NRA, thank you as always, and we'll be talking to you next week with some new topics and figure out where the NRA is going to help conserve and protect our rights and our freedoms. Thanks again, Joe.
And thanks, Ben. Have a great show.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate the call. Thanks again, Joe. We will be going now to take a little break for about a minute or two, and then Victor DiCasola from Tactical Night Vision is coming on. His company has an awesome website. If you guys are online now, go to tnvc.com and go ahead and start poking around there. It's a really cool website. We will be talking to him about some cool night vision stuff, and it's a very informative, and we're going to take a minute or two here and be right back with you as soon as we get Victor on the line. Be right back, folks. Welcome back to Radio Free ARFCOM. This is Benjamin, your host, and we just got off the line with Joe DeBregalis from the NRA, and our next guest is Vic DeCasola. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. He is the president, CEO, Tactical Night Vision Company, and here is just a little bit from his about page. TNVC exists to provide the absolute best night vision and related gear to the warfighter, law enforcement professional, and civilian market. Our core foundation is night vision and its tactical application. He's got former and current warfighters and law enforcement professionals in his company as well. He says here they test and train extensively with the gear that they use. They do not use or sell any gear that they would not be comfortable putting their life on the line with, so they constantly are training and testing their gear, and that's the only stuff that they sell. One of the things that I really like about this site is if you go to the, again, tnvc.com, and you go to the technology tab, it says how do night vision devices work, and you've got your image intensifiers, your thermal imagers, and a very, very detailed, technical, and informative explanation of that technology and the different generations of night vision and so on and so forth. So very nice, very easy to navigate website. Some really cool stuff on there, and boy, if you want some cool night vision stuff for your, whether it be monoculars, binoculars, or if you want weapon lights, accessories, you name it, they've got it. So on the line with me is Victor. How you doing today, sir? And nice speaking with you here on Radio Free ARFCOM.
Good, Benjamin. Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show. I know we were on about a couple months back, and I'm glad to be back. It's great.
Excellent. Yeah, we're certainly glad to have you. So what's new in the world of tactical night vision?
Well, last show we talked a lot about the introduction night vision 101. We talked about the generations of tubes, how they differentiated, things of that nature, kind of went into some of the basics. So a little bit of technical stuff. I'm glad you brought out the kind of the history of night vision and where it's been, and more of the technical questions can be answered on our website as well. We went into some of the applications for rifle scopes and night vision and rifle scopes. We left off on some of the good systems, such as thermal, some of the advantages and disadvantages versus night vision, which they call I2 systems. So that was, I got pinged a lot from the show, which was a great show. Once again, we thank you for being on there, having us on there. We spoke to a lot of folks on instant messaging on the ARFCOM, as well as personal emails and telephone calls about, hey, what are some of the advantages of thermal? Well, obviously, thermal, if folks don't know, is basically you see heat, heat that emanates from a human body or any other object, an animal, critter, the heat that's generated off that, a thermal device, basically the thermal core itself, picks up that heat signature and displays it on a view screen, and you get to see that image. What's good about that, obviously, for hunters out there, if a coyote or a hog, especially, we have a lot of hog customers like yourself, I heard you in the previous show talking, you're an avid hog hunter, we find a lot of times, a lot of hogs, especially in Texas, might hide out like near a riverbed, and you have long grass or some type of other obstructions that night vision can't see because the hogs basically are inside the weeds and you just can't see them. That all changes, obviously, with a thermal device. You can see them clear as day, and that is a huge advantage for a lot of folks looking for critters and other hunting type applications where a normal night vision device might have a hard time in getting obscured as a critter might blend in or be inside these loose, tall grass weeds, and you just can't see them. So a whole new world might open up when using a thermal device. Of course, everything has the drawbacks, and the drawbacks, especially for law enforcement we talked to about, is the actual resolution versus a night vision device. Thermal devices really lack the overall resolution for facial recognition and very good details. And for law enforcement who need to collect evidence, appear in front of juries and courts, need to always have good resolution, very good type of evidence gathering type technology to present before court for the action that they might have had to partake in using the device. I2 technology, night vision, offers you very, very good resolution in that regard. Some of the other advantages of thermal, obviously, you can see basically through smoke and rain, or fog in that aspect. A lot of firefighters obviously look thermal for room searching when they go into a home or structure. It has a lot of smoke. Thermal devices can see a victim in a room where night vision would be rendered useless in most smoke environments. So a lot of advantages for the fire department folks that use thermal. Obviously, another disadvantage for thermal may be the price point. Most of them are very pricey. Some of the handheld units that you see, and there's different variations that we see handheld systems that are in the, some of them the low end are in the $4,000 to $6,000 neighborhood. Some of the dedicated rifle scopes are into the $10,000, $15,000, and $20,000 range. They get very, very pricey when you start talking putting them on a weapon. So maybe some of the other disadvantages versus night vision, obviously, could be the price points that you see of thermal versus night vision. So with that said, we have the best of both worlds. We have hybrid systems that are out there now, too. ITT has their version, as well as Optical Systems Technology has another version, what they call hybrid, where they interweave the actual night vision and thermal. And if I look into my crystal ball, I think as we go forward 10 years from now, the mainstream is going to be a hybrid system that we see now that interweave both technologies. So you basically get the best of both worlds, the best of thermal and the best of I2 technology. They're not quite there yet, in my opinion. I think the combination of two are still not equal to a dedicated system. When they're interweaving, we still lose some resolution and some clarity issues with the thermal device when they're on the hybrid. They're interweaved from what the ones I've looked at and worked with from ITT and some of the other systems. I think they're getting close. I think we have a little bit ways to go, and of course, the price point at the moment are very, very expensive. And presently, all the hybrid systems that we do see are only for law enforcement and military. And I do not know if those will become readily available to the commercial market. And I guess they will be, but for the time being, they are restricted for LE military use only. So that's kind of a in the ballpark kind of wrap up of the thermal devices and how they relate with night vision as well.
Now, one of the things that you touched on that I found interesting was you were speaking about the civilian application, not just in terms of what, you know, an average Joe like me might be doing, but that application for your, you know, sort of your EMS, your firefighters, your getting away from what most people would traditionally think of in terms of military or law enforcement, you know, where we think of that sort of traditional role of night vision and what we see in the, and, you know, the movies and TV depictions and documentaries and so on and so forth. But have you found that more municipalities are beginning to incorporate some of this stuff into some of the thermal type imaging into their, you know, EMS and fire crews? And if so, how is that, as far as price point goes, is that potentially a barrier as well?
It is for the thermal, and I'll preface by saying first, indeed, to answer the first part of your question, we are seeing more and more law enforcement and especially law enforcement getting more federal grants, Homeland Defense grants. We see a very good onslaught of buying power for the local police departments, even the small departments that we've never seen before. From many years ago till now, it's really a big difference of the funding that's opened up for the grant systems for the law enforcement. The fire department folks, you know, they've kind of known about the secret of thermals for a long period of time. We always have a steady sale of fire department folks that are always buying thermals. I don't see we haven't seen much of the sales. More fire departments buying thermals. There's always a steady stream of fire department folks buying that sort of devices. What we have seen is more municipality law enforcement, small departments getting into night vision for the first time. But with that said, to kind of end on your second part of your question is, because of the price points with thermal, we do see more night vision versus thermal, obviously, out there for some of the municipalities, the local law enforcement, some small departments, because of that price point. One typical, you know, thermal device, they could probably buy 3 to 4 night vision devices. So we find for the majority of law enforcement customers, they're really still buying more night vision than they are thermal devices. And from the resolution aspect we talked about as well, that they really do need to have that resolution versus the thermal resolution at the moment, that sometimes at 100 meters to 200 meters, a human body might look like the abominable snowman versus good facial features and a good body outline, what night vision can bring to you in the I2 technology.
And in terms of the law enforcement applications, you said that obviously more in smaller municipalities, do you find that its role is limited to what you would consider a traditional, where it would be potentially a SWAT or a special response team, or are you finding that it's becoming more widespread in use among, you know, what you would not potentially consider your more tactical officers, but your sort of just detectives, other, you know, sort of, I guess, non-tactical units? Are they also incorporating the night vision systems as well?
Some. The majority still, I would say, the probably 70-30 is still SWAT and entry team type folks that are using the night vision. Out of that percentage, the other 30%, we see the normal, you know, beat cop out there using night vision. And a lot of those beat cops, you know, basically are using and buying night vision out of their own pocket. They might opt for maybe a early Gen 3 or a good resolution type Gen 2 devices to keep in their squad car if somebody in the rural areas might run into a forest and they need a quick search, quick assessment before they go, you know, trouncing out of the forest to make sure they can find the suspect before they go running out of their unit. So we find still about 70% of the SWATy type guys are buying the night vision for their entry teams and the clip-on devices for their snipers as well.
And you were speaking, in addition to the, you know, I'm looking here on your website, it's not just your what I would consider your, you know, your goggles or your imaging devices, but where are you seeing the weapons type platforms going as far as weapons mounted technologies, and what are some of the applications for that for both military and law enforcement?
Good question. Two versions of the weapon. We have the dedicated weapon platforms, which are dedicated night vision rifle scopes. And then we have the clip-on devices, which we talked of, that actually clip in front of a day scope, such as the PVS-22s, the PVS-27s. And the clip-ons, as we call it, are just that. They clip on in front of a day scope. So the user can use his regular day scope and peer through the night vision device, such as the PVS-22 or 27, that's out in front of the day scope. And then, of course, the huge advantage of that is you don't day scope on at any time to peer through the night vision device and not worried about losing your day dope or your zero, however you want to call it. So your zero always remains the same. It never changes. So that point of aim, point of impact that you shoot during the day, as soon as you introduce the PVS-22 or 27 in front of the day scope, you will have that same point of aim, point of impact. So there's no difference in the way you shoot or any different type of elevation or windage type changes. That system works coherently with your day optic. Now, and of course, for law enforcement and military, that's a big deal because they would have to basically have a night vision rifle set up if they had a dedicated rifle scope, and then they would have a day system as well in place of their night vision rifle scope. So basically, it might sound real expensive for a 22 or 27, but you're basically combining two rifle systems into one, which a lot of military and police have found that years ago is a big advantage. We probably see that because we don't see a lot of Raptors. One of the best mil-spec units probably out there as a dedicated rifle scope is a Raptor. And there's basically no substitute for a dedicated night vision rifle scope. It brings in a heck of a lot of light, you know, from their large objective lenses that go from 88 millimeters all the way up to 165 millimeters. So huge objectives that bring in all sorts of light. And the images in a typical 4X or 6X dedicated rifle scope, night vision dedicated rifle scope, are superb. They're very crisp. And we're not saying there's the PVS-22 clip-ons or 27 clip-ons are any slouch by any sense of imagination. But there is always a certain amount of magnification you can crank up in a PVS-22, and let's say in a semi-urban or semi-rural area. You know, the sweet spot of a PVS-22, cranking up your day scope to about 8X is about the sweet spot in a 68-millimeter objective on a PVS-22. And when we talk about a PVS-27, which basically brings in a heck of a lot of light at about 120 millimeter or so objective on that system. You can get away with cranking up the magnification to about 12x or so without any artificial IR. So with that said, better pay a rifle scopes, a superb image, but limited, obviously, with the logistics. You only can use it at night. It can't be used as a day scope, so you have to switch your day scope back and forth. Clip-on devices have all the ultimate versatility for putting a device out in front of your day scope. So those are the primary differences, kind of advantages, disadvantages for both systems that are out there. The hunters we see, like the hog hunters, most of those guys are still using dedicated night vision rifle scopes, and they're all, there's the price point to talk about. You know, we're looking at $4,000 to $5,000 for a good dedicated night vision rifle scope, a quality dedicated night vision rifle scope, and you're looking at the $8,000 to $10,000 price point for a clip-on device, such as the ones we offer from OSTI, which are PVS 22 and 27. So it's quite a bit of price difference between the two, and you can only imagine it's probably the necessity of the price points for the hunters really opt to go with the dedicated rifle scopes for that reason.
If anybody wants some further information, I'm here on the TNVC.com page, and if you go to the left and you scroll down and you click on night vision weapon sights, right now I'm looking at the AN-PVS 27 MUNS, which is the Magnum Universal Night Sight. He's got a great photo up here of this thing, and this is just the Mac Daddy of the night sights. I mean, this thing is awesome. Definitely, if you're online right now, again, it's TNVC.com, and just take a look at some of this technology that they've got in here, and it's really unbelievable if you look at some of this stuff. He says on the website, the UNS is optimized for medium and long range sniper weapons, rifles, and machine guns, including the MK-11, the MK-12, the M16A4, SCAR-H, OSR, M240, and M24, and is rated for calibers up to and including 50 BMG. That being said, the question that I would ask Victor is, what type of rifle platforms are you typically seeing most of these optics applied to, as far as which weapon system do you see a very positive sort of use from on here, and which is sort of being the most used weapon system in conjunction with these optic systems?
308s, basically, for most of the law enforcement applications that we see. Occasional 338s and 50 BMGs, but majority, obviously, are the 308s are still the mainstay of law enforcement. We see the military, obviously, using up to 50 BMGs, but we see the 338s basically used in many, many circles. And these both these units, the 27s, the MUNS, the Magnum Universal, and the Universal Night Sight, the UNS 22, are rated for these recoils. OSTI especially has a shock mitigation system. It's a patented shock mitigation system that's built into the system. These are very harsh recoil weapons, or 375 or 415s. They actually recoil harder than the 50 BMGs. And I remember many in-depth talks on some other projects we were working on with Leupold at one time. We talked with the engineers, specifically, you know, the scope designers, that told us the sharp recoil are really from the 338s, because they do that measuring curve when the shot and the recoil is felt. Well, that curve, that recoil curve, is very, very fast for 338s. It's up and down very fast. Those are really, really could do a lot of damage to optics. The 338s, 375s, 415s, where we see the 50 BMGs, that recoil might feel harsh or strong. It's actually slower around the curve. That up and down motion, if you want to draw the spike and the recoil lasting effect, is actually longer than the 338, so it's not as sharp. So these PVS 22s and 27s, that's the key for a lot of these systems out there that are used for the military, the 338s that are out there. They're very, very sharp recoil systems. So see the military using that a lot in a lot of our work. Both the 27s and 22s and 27s really hold up to those sharp recoil effects of those sharp hitting calibers such as the 338. The other rifle scopes, the dedicated rifle scopes, the Raptors that you see on our website, once again, these systems are rated up to a 50 BMG. But most times from the law enforcement end of it, we do see the majority of hunters and law enforcement using 308 platforms. We do, of course, hear the 300 Winchesters, some 338s, but the majority of hunters that we work with and talk with, most of them are still out there at 308 to 30-06 type.
In regards to that, you know, obviously there's going to be budgets and things for, you know, for municipalities, for the federal government, and so on and so forth, for your law enforcement, military applications that, you know, obviously price point is a big deal for everybody, but in particular for, you know, average Joe who might want to get a night vision, whether it be a dedicated weapon system with a sight on it, or whether it just be, you know, nice to have a set of night vision goggles or binoculars or camera for whatever civilian application you can imagine, from hunting to, you know, wildlife photography or whatever the case may be. Do you see, you know, a trend of hopefully declining prices? I mean, obviously the price has got to be a scare away, you know, many of us who may or may not have several, you know, thousands of dollars to put into a system. And is that trending like many other technologies, where it used to be the computer that I'm talking to you through right now would have been unheard of for a price that NASA couldn't even afford, whereas nowadays, with the advent of technology and it growing and growing, it's obviously becoming cheaper and cheaper. Is there a level that you feel it's going to be getting closer to within reach of your average, you know, average AR-15 owner or AR-15.com member?
It will, but it takes more time than, Ian. It's a good question, by the way, but it's going to take more time than most of the industries, like computers that, the moment they go out the door, you know, 2 months later, they're $300 or $400 cheaper. Night vision, until we see the next generation, maybe it's the hybrid systems that do it, I'm not sure, because there is no official Gen 4 designation as yet. But until we see the advent of a new generation, a new type technology, a true new type technology, we'll probably always see Gen 3 devices hover where they're at or even go even higher, because the prices for tubes every year seem to go up in price. From IDT or Litton tubes seem to go up every year, and they've been doing that. But you see, when the technology is, a new technology is developed, then you see the prices, you know, tumble or slowly meet that a low-level basement price like we do with Gen 2 systems. You know, basically they were stopped being produced in the late 80s, but we still see those Gen 3 prices that have been around for the last, I would say, 6 to 10 years, kind of hover at the same price as where they're at now. They've even gone higher. So they do come down, but it's going to take the next level of technology to bring them down. And at the moment, I think we're going to be seeing Gen 3 pricing basically where it's at, or maybe even a little bit higher, unfortunately, for Gen 3 devices. You know, there is some very good Gen 2 systems we talked about in the last show, and some of, especially one now, it's called the M845 system. It's a Gen 2 Plus system, dedicated rifle scope, which is just a hair under $2,000. It's probably one of the best hidden secrets out there for varmint hunting. You know, it's a 2.5x system, not very high power, but it's 2.5x with a 2 MOA dot, and the resolution is very, very close to some of the early Gen 3. It's got great resolution, and so for folks who are definitely on a price point and have a limited budget, and we really understand that, we kind of point them into some of the higher-end Gen 2 stuff. But unfortunately, pricing for Gen 3 at the moment is going to go up before it comes down, until we have some new breakthrough, some new level of technology. Maybe it's going to be the hybrid system that's going to drive the prices of Gen 3 systems down, because they're in the probably 17 to 20K system right now for most of the hybrid systems. Once that supply and demand get to a point where we have mass production and good consumer-type purchasing, that will be the way to drive Gen 3 down. So at the moment, unfortunately, we don't see Gen 3 prices going down anytime soon, hopefully we'll see that trend change as the next level of generations come on out there.
Looking on your website here, and you have a very strong statement as far as, it says, bottom line, if we do not test a piece of kit to find out if we would bet our lives on it, we will not offer it to our customers.
Yes, that's so
end
true.
Quote. How do you go about testing this stuff in such a way that you you know, can say a statement such as that?
Well,
what are you?
Well, not only myself, I try to base everything on myself and shoot everything we get. I have Chip Lasky, who's also an ex-warfighter. He also tests gear. Some of the other gear that's out, we also have a test bed of shooters that are active military, ex-military, that are at our disposal that we use a lot. We lean a lot about. We lean a lot in the LE community as well as military community. So we, not only between myself and Chip Lasky, he's Klasky, by the way, in the ARFCOM, we keep busy quite a bit, whether it's not just doing what we do to run the business, we shoot a lot with a lot of gear. And it takes us a long time, you know, to put something on our website. Not only it's the buy and sell thing, we get something, but we also, as you know, manufacture a few things ourselves that we'll probably talk about here shortly. But the we have a lot of folks who want us to try things out, and there's just not a lot of time, but there's other gear that's not even on our website yet that's going to be there a couple months from now because we need to shoot it. We're, even though it might be the best thing since sliced bread, I want to shoot it and know for myself how the system works because, more importantly, I also train, and we also train with the Magpul Dynamics folks as well. We have a night operators course that we both share, and they have a wealth of knowledge in the day operations, and we try to supplement that with our night operations. So if I don't understand the latest, greatest technology of equipment, I sure can't go out there and train the guys with it effectively as well. So not only am I learning how a system works with a maybe top thermal or night vision manufacturer out there that designs systems, we also want to get behind the trigger and make sure it works as advertised. I can't take anybody's word for that because not only is lives on the line, if I get something into a SWAT sniper and say, this is it, go shoot it, this is the do-all, and the system fails in the field, you know, we have a big issue. Lives are at stake, not only me. You know, I'm an ex, come from an ex-LE background myself. I have a great issue with that those systems are not tested. They're not tested appropriately. Even though a manufacturer states that or somebody else might state that, for me personally, I took a more of an approach when the corporations first came out there, my night vision company. I said to myself, no system will not get tested by me or from one of my staff members thoroughly before it goes out there in the market. It's just a policy of mine. I will always live that way to run this company that way. I'm very serious about that. As you can probably tell by the tone of my voice, I get very serious about gear, especially when it goes out to our warfighters and LE guys. I'm very, very serious about that sort of stuff. It's got to work, and it's got to work effectively as advertised in the best field conditions it can to make sure it never fails in the field. So that's my philosophy. Here nor there, bad or good, it's a philosophy that I live with and always will be as long as I'm doing what I do best. And I hope it's for the best. I hope it gives our warfighters and our law enforcement personnel, or even it trickles down to the hunters. I hope it tells them that, you know, a guy's just tried it. We've tried it, we've used it, we've tested it, we train with it, and I hope it helps them. I hope in the LE guys it saves lives, because that's what this is all about, and it's a very serious situation out there we find all of ourselves in when it comes down to, you know, doing the war fighting things and doing the LE things. So I think as I go forward, I will always keep that philosophy. I will never change that. And that's why it takes so long to get stuff on our website. There's probably a dozen items that are in testing right now that aren't on our website. Not because they're not good, it's just that we're not done testing them yet. We're not done learning the system ourselves to find the idiosyncrasies of the disadvantages and advantages, but they'll eventually get there. So that's why on our website you'll see, hey, XYZ might have this product. I don't see it on TNVC's website yet. That might be, but we're just not done testing it yet. And I guess that's the other advantage, is when folks do call, we really try to know the product inside and out. And whether that's just a normal hunter that's out there from the commercial end of it, or the LE or the warfighter, at least they can come to us and we can hold a conversation with them and tell them our experiences, what we found, what really, really works, and what might have some lacking disadvantage to that system. So we're not all about just selling the gear, but we're also about using it and also training and giving the feedback to anybody that calls about how they think a system should work or how it does not work. So there you have it.
Yeah, definitely. That is very good, I think, of you as not just a person, but as a company, you know, because obviously the lives of our men and women in uniform, you know, as well as the people they protect are obviously of the utmost importance. We've got about 5 minutes left for you. I hate to cut you short again, but we've got about 5 minutes left for you. So if you can, go ahead and start telling us about some of the things we'd like to see and expect on your website that will be available for everybody, and just tell us about what you got coming up here for a few minutes.
The newest thing we have, we're really excited about it, is our new TM14. It's our new PVS-14 twist mount. We looked at the industry and looked some lacking things of wearing a helmet-mounted PVS-14, and somebody might want to quickly go behind like an aimpoint top-type optic on an AR-15 type 5.56 platform. So we came out with a quick detach, basically, that uses the aimpoint twist base. It's called the TM14. And you can use the aimpoint twist base, which also uses like the 3X magnifier, same base. And we made a mount that locks in behind the lens locking ring, not on the lens, but a lens locking ring with a little ring and a base on it. It's a smooth ring, so you don't have to worry about a stem or the attachment point blocking the IR illuminator, the PVS-14, or more importantly, the gain knob. And so you can wear the PVS-14 J-arm helmet mount adapter at the same time it's on the weapon. So you can go from your weapon to your head and head to your weapon in under 10 seconds. It's very fast. So for the LE guy who needs it, or warfighter who needs to take the passive shot, who can't broadcast his IR laser all over God's creation, he can quickly go from his helmet to his weapon to take that quick shot and to have a reticle at any time for your PVS-14 for a low-caliber weapon, such as a 5.56. So that's one product called the TM-14. We're really happy about it. It came out just about 60 days ago. So we're real happy about the new TM-14. And most recently, we came out with our new RSP. It's kind of not a night vision product. We're known to kind of look at the industry and kind of make innovative type products. And the new Riser stock pouch for the M1A, personally, I was very tired of watching our men and women in uniform using pillows and duct tapes for the M1As or the M14s. We see thousands of new rifles going out there nowadays with some of our Middle East war fighting. And I finally came out with a Riser stock pouch for the M1A M14. It uses a fixed foam riser stock pouch. It's got a 308 magazine on the right side, so you can quickly switch out a mag if need be. And it gets your head up for scoped M14s or M1As. So it's a good system. No more pillows and duct tapes for warfighters out there, even LE guys. As you know, the chin welds were horrendous. You couldn't even get a cheek weld on a scoped M14 M1A. And a lot of folks don't have the fancy or really heavy and expensive Sage stock, so we did the M14 with U.S. Palm. We teamed up together, and we did them in tan, and we got OD in black and multicam coming out here in a lefty version here in next month or so. So that's our other new product that hit the market here in the last 30 days. And, of course, we have our new, in closing, our new TX4 drop-in heads, drop-in headlamps for the Surefire weapon lights and some of the G2s, E2s. That's a supplement to our Q5s that are out there, and our 600 lumen brightness heads that are now out there for the Surefire weapon line of lights. So we're real happy about those three products, and we hope just to continue with the industry and really start innovating, continue to innovate what we're doing, what we're seeing out there to kind of help the community even more than what we see now. So that's what we have right now that you can see that's brand new.
Well, Victor, again, Victor DiCasola, President, CEO of Tactical Night Vision Company. Again, it's tnvc.com. We really appreciate your time with us. His website is absolutely awesome. Even if you just want to go and look at it, the photography on here alone is amazing. Very high quality stuff. Very easy to navigate website. And very informative. You just want to learn about some new technology, you can click on the technology tab, and there's a very, very technical yet easy to understand technology for both thermal imaging as well as night vision. It's a very good website. Again, thank you very much for your time, Vic, and you're welcome to come back anytime. And again, tnvcd.com. And we will say thanks, Victor, for coming on Radio Free ARFCOM.
Benjamin, thank you. It's a real pleasure as always, and glad you guys do what you do. It's great for the community out there. So thanks again for having me.
Thanks, sir. We will talk to you again soon. You're welcome anytime to call in, and we'll have you on.
Hey, thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Okay, Radio Free ARFCOM listeners, I hope you enjoyed that. We really appreciate Victor from Tactical Night Vision coming on. Up next, we're going to have a very quick little break. We're going to be speaking to a good friend of mine named Jeff Waite. He operates an 85-acre shooting facility here in Florida, but he's very knowledgeable about all the different aspects of shooting, and we're going to talk to him about some different trends. We're going to take a quick break. Also, again, the number to call in is 415-762-1161. And also, you know, during these breaks, if any of you listeners out there know any advertisers that might be willing to sponsor or underwrite the show, we'd be more than happy to speak with you. You can IM me at FL_flyfishing_guide at AR15.com, and I'd be happy to take any calls, emails from you. On the line now, we'll go ahead and just skip the break. We're online with Jeff Waite from Okeechobee Shooting Sports. His website is okshooting.com. It's a really nice, all brand new facility. I personally shoot out there just about every week. Whether you want to shoot shotgun, rifles, you know, they have a tactical facility. They have some different events going on out there. I mean, they really do it all. It's all brand new, all NRA certified range safety officers, as well as NRA certified instructors. All around nice facility, very family oriented, very classy, and a classy individual as well. Jeff, welcome to the program. You're on Radio Free ARFCOM, buddy.
Thanks, Ben. Glad to be here.
Thanks. One of the things that I wanted to speak with you about was, like we were talking, and we see in the gun store and in the gun industry, is, and when we were talking to our distributor last week, what are some of the trends you're seeing as far as what are people really doing a lot of, and what are you seeing a lot of in terms of not only just firearms, but also in terms of the clientele that you're attracting out of your facility? And you can go ahead if you'd like to just describe your facility any better than mine for our listeners as well.
Well, you did great. We did try to build a facility that was geared towards the most diverse group of shooters that we could, covering from just regular target shooters to those that want to practice defensive shooting or tactical, as well as clay shooters. So we try to do as many things to enjoy the shooting sports as possible, being that there's so few places to do it, which is how we came to be making ours. But you really do see such a wide variety of people out there, every income level, every background, and being in South Florida, from every part of the country and even the world out there. So the clientele is very, very diverse that comes to us. Certainly in the last few years, especially in the last 1 or 2 years, the defensive weapons more prolific at the range over the target weapons that you normally saw at ranges was a target firearm, where, you know, people were just concerned with the sport shooting itself and accuracy and matches. And now when you look down the line, you see a much stronger presence of defensive pistols or rifles, even shotguns, that people are really starting to practice more for their own self-defense, as opposed to the vast majority that used to be was just target shooting for fun. So people are trying to make sure that they're skilled and prepared to protect themselves as well as enjoy their sport.
In addition to just you're saying a diverse amount of weapons, are you seeing, in terms of clientele, you were speaking about the diversity of it, are you seeing a much in the way of increase in women, youth shooters, or any other, what you might consider the non sort of stereotypical, you know, white middle class guy out there? I mean, young, old, you know, women, all sorts of stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, the amount of families that come out there is tremendous. We've built our facility with the family in mind. Typical, you know, a lot of places were just like the good old boys hunting camp gun club. Even their wives didn't go there most of the time, where now we have such a strong presence of women out there and youth. And, you know, we really watch our demographics pretty well, And as far as the youth that come, we really have about 60% girls that come with their parents as opposed to 40% of boys that come. And, you know, I don't know if there's just more girls than boys as far as kids go now or what, but certainly the girls are jumping into the sport heavily. And, you know, most of the time they outshoot the boys, which is pretty disheartening for the young men. But girls shoot well, and they're all working at it really hard. The girls have a great time. You know, the shooting sports are great because it doesn't matter what age you are, what sex you are, and usually even your physical shape. Everybody can enjoy them, and everybody can do it well. So that's one of the great sports that everybody in the family can go out and do. Grandparents all the way down to, you know, young kids, they all can do it. And since Florida's concealed weapon permits have been going like crazy, I mean, they've been just, as you can tell in your store, you know, everybody in the world, it seems like, is trying to get a Florida permit. And once they have that, they're all out there wanting to learn how to shoot the firearm that they have to make sure that they're competent with it. So you get a lot more people that didn't or wouldn't have got into target shooting. Now they're getting into it because they bought a defensive pistol, whether they're older and or whether they're a woman that normally didn't think of shooting before. Now the defensive pistol is bringing people into it that weren't. We're also seeing a lot of older couples, say, from the Northeast that are retired and never touched a firearm in their entire life, are now getting into it. So typically, you know, when people start shooting, they're brought into it at a young age by their father or grandfather or some other family member, where now we're getting people that have they're already retired and they've never owned a firearm or shot one before that are coming out to start to learn how. So there's definitely a strong market out there of people getting into it now that didn't even consider it before.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the same things that I see all the time as far as where we go, is that there's all kinds of different different people going. Now, you, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys opened up the new facility in August of last year.
And Labor Day, yep.
Labor Day, yeah. What were some of the challenges that you faced that, you know, sort of, I don't know if you would say be unexpected, but what are some of the challenges, not just specific to your range, but do you think as far as firearm ranges in general across the country, what are, you know, the challenges as far as not just opening, but also, you know, what are just some of the hurdles that you have to jump through to go into something like this in regards to, you know, we don't have a lot of places, particularly in our location, but I'm sure, you know, throughout the country, there's a lot of people that are really struggling to find, you know, a place where they can go and enjoy the shooting sports and their freedoms.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up because, you know, the first thing you have to start out with when you're going to build a shooting range of any size is an enormous pile of money. And whatever you think you need to get it going, you know, you need to double or triple that usually. I just came back from a range conference that the NRA puts on where they help people start their range or improve their range, what have you. And what they determined was to start the smallest range takes about $1.5 million, and to build the range that you really like is about $3 million. And a lot of people think, you know, what are you talking about? I've got 20 acres out in the woods somewhere, and I got a buddy with a bobcat. We can push some dirt around and make a shooting range, you know, for a couple thousand bucks in diesel fuel. And, you know, it just doesn't really go that way. You know, not only do you have the purchase of land to think about, and, you know, do you have enough land, what's around you, you know, you can think that you've got it all figured out. And a person that, you know, doesn't even live anywhere near your range, they could be a mile away, 2 miles away, gets to say something at the zoning hearing that, you know, they don't like guns, they don't want to hear a firearm ever go off. And you know, what was funny was one of the ranges I've been to, the people were complaining about their shooting range, and the people that were complaining owned a large dog kennel. I don't know that you could have heard anything over their dog kennel, but here they were complaining, and the shooting range was having to defend itself against a noisy dog kennel. So, you know, you wouldn't think these things are factors, and you would think common sense would prevail when you're trying to start a shooting range, and it really doesn't. when you have to go through a zoning board or you have to go through public hearings to be able to get your range approved, or a building department, you know, people's feelings towards firearms and the Second Amendment can affect your mission to build your range greatly. They will find if somebody's anti-gun in your city government or your building department, they're going to make it as cost prohibitive as possible for you to build it. And also, if there's a neighbor around there that doesn't like somebody that shoots, they might complain and go to a hearing because they don't like, you know, one of the guys that they don't like shoots, and they don't want him anywhere near the house. I mean, people have the strangest reasons for trying to stop the development of a range or even close an existing range. But it's a constant challenge, and if you don't have a law degree, you'll become a lawyer by the time you're done trying to do it. And you know, the challenges of design, trying to accommodate a lot of different types of shooters. Many ranges are, as you know, that you've been to, are geared towards a specific shooting discipline, which is nice if you can do that. Since there's so few ranges around us, we really needed to make one that was for multi-discipline to try to cover as many people as we could, because it does cost so much to build and maintain and develop a range that if you were going to do a small one, you'd never make it. You need to get the masses there to be able to keep the doors open. And the NRA is great for range development. I think anybody, if they're thinking of opening or improving or trying to keep their range open, they do, I think, 2 or 3 seminars a year for their range development class, their seminars, and it's the best money you'll ever spend. It's the best week of your life you'll ever spend before you blow a fortune. They have just amazing experts that go to this seminar that really show you the right way to do it and what things to stay away from and what things to make sure that you do. And that's just priceless for somebody that's doing it. But, you know, they're finding the right architect. A lot of people, you know, my buddy's an architect, or, you know, there's a guy downtown, I think that's one. You really need to find one which you're going to build a range that understands shooting ranges, that has designed them before. There's a lot of nuances that go into it to make it safe and make it right and make it lasting. Anybody you have involved in the project, you need to make sure is an absolute expert in shooting ranges, not just he's a good general contractor, or he's a good engineer, or a good civil engineer, or a good architect. They need to be experienced in the shooting industry. They need to be shooters themselves and understand what the layout of the place needs to be to accommodate shooters so it's enjoyable to them. I mean, there's every aspect in the world that you have to do. And, you know, indoor ranges have a lot of other challenges, too. I mean, we couldn't do what we do at an indoor range, but indoor ranges are great because you can have them in town where large facilities like ours have to be, you know, quite a drive out of town. But they, even though they don't have the same, you know, noise issues or bullet trap issues that we do, they have a whole lot, because if you have a building official that doesn't want you there, they'll find every reason why you can't open it, or they'll look for every reason why to shut your range down. So there's huge challenges and there's huge expenses to do it, but and you'll find most people that have a shooting range, they have it just because they love the sport. I don't know too many of them that are getting wealthy off of it. You know, it's just that they love it and they want to share it. So they work really hard at it every day to try to get that range done and to keep the doors open on it.
Tell me a little bit about your approach to your facility. I know you and I have talked before, and sort of when I – you know, we sort of, I think, share a lot of the same visions as far as what, you know, you sort of are looking for in it. And I sort of think of what you're trying to do as, like, the Disney World of shooting. Your place is, for those that don't know, description-wise, I mean, it is a large facility. It's got, I believe, 85 acres. You've got every discipline there to shoot. And not only that, but you're incorporating to have a little restaurant there. You're going to be having the pro shop opening up soon, and looking at a place like that, it's a destination to get to. It's not a place that, you know, that you can even or would even want to go just spend 15 minutes or a half hour, pop off 100 rounds and leave. I mean, it's the type of destination where you can go there for a day or a weekend or several days and do absolutely everything and sort of tell me about what led you to sort of that approach and sort of where you want to end up with that outcome.
Well, we did have the Walt Disney vision, and we still do. If you build it, they will come. And our goal, as you said, it was a destination. We just didn't want a shooting range that people could just go by real quick, sight in their rifle, and go off to hunting. We really wanted a shooting park, a facility that people were going to spend the whole day or the whole weekend at, and just bring all their firearms with them that they enjoy, or bring people with them that have never shot before, to make sure it's a great environment for helping to teach them. And, you know, we wanted it so once you got there, there was no reason for you to have to go somewhere else. That's why, you know, a restaurant on site. That's why a fully stocked pro shop. So if you forgot something, you didn't have to go all the way home to go get it. You know, from ammunition to earplugs to magazines for your guns, locks to open them if you forgot your key. You know, there's just a whole bunch of things like that we've tried to consider so that when a shooter comes out there, they can spend the whole day and just have a great time enjoying themselves and not watch a clock. You know, there's a lot of ranges that do it per hour or things like that. Or, you know, once you've left your lane, you can't go back there again. You got to repay and things like that. We really just wanted it to where it was a good relaxing time. People could go out and enjoy themselves. They could try different types of shooting disciplines. Maybe they were a pistol shooter the whole time, and maybe they want to try rifle shooting, or like you do, you know, you're really enjoying the clay shooting now, which is one of my favorites. You know, a lot of people haven't tried it before, and since we have instructors at every field, you know, we have shotguns for them. They can try it out. So they're not just going to do the one thing that they've always done. We try to open up their horizons to as many shooting disciplines as we can so that they can really have a great time with it. So, you know, having a place that's going to be a draw for not only the community that we're in to bring people to, but really give some people a great way to enjoy it and to learn other things, and having a place where they could come and spend the day that's comfortable, as opposed to a lot of ranges just have a little bench outside the shooting area, and that's all you get to do. We really wanted to have it to where people could watch a gunsmith at work or get their gun fitted to them, take some classes, find some books that they were doing. I mean, there's be as much shopping there for the shooting enthusiasts as there is shooting. And that way it's also a lot more open for people that are going to bring, say, maybe their neighbor that was thinking of buying a gun and they've never been to a shooting range before, never even held a gun. We wanted a very positive feel to the whole facility so that when they bring them in, it isn't the typical kind of grungy little gun shop that isn't that appealing to the average consumer. We wanted one where they got there and they just, you know, they just couldn't believe where they were at, and they just had a great time from the minute they stepped in the door.
Again, on the line with us is Jeff Waite. He operates Okeechobee Shooting Sports here in Okeechobee, Florida, one of our local ranges. Again, all brand new facilities. It's okshooting.com. That's the letter O, the letter K, shooting.com, okshooting.com. He has a very nice facility out there, and like I said, we were speaking. If you guys have any questions for myself or for Jeff, it's 415-762-1161 here on Radio Free ARFCOM. One of the things that I was thinking about, Jeff, is as far as, you know, you have all these instructors and you know, everybody's certified, and not to sound ironic, no, a bit on our relationship personally, but how are your issues as far as staffing and whatnot goes, and where are you finding you know, is everybody, you know, it seems like it would be a very fun job. And for those of us, for those listeners that may not be real familiar with what a, you know, a typical range officer does, can you sort of go through a, you know, sort of a day in the life of a range officer and some of their responsibilities and some of the things that for the instructors and whatnot, what they do and sort of what their perspective is on it?
Yeah, you know, as you say, staffing is the challenge of any business, besides the guy that sells ice cream by himself. Anything over that is staffing is definitely an issue. And at, you know, being at your gun shop too, you'll find people walk in every day to go, you should hire me. You know, everybody wants to work at a gun range or a gun shop, it seems sometimes. And very few of them you may want on, may really want on staff. I mean, there's a lot of people that have great knowledge of firearms, but that doesn't mean that they're a great representative of your company. And, you know, very typical thing in the firearm industry, you know, it's just a terrible reputation for gun shop owners as these grumpy, opinionated guys that you know, you look at you cross-eyed when you walk in the door. And trying to make sure that we don't have that image and that we have a welcoming, professional image is a challenge. I mean, it's very important to me, the cleanliness of our facility, and that our staff has a smile. And, you know, safety is our number one thing that we work on. After safety comes customer satisfaction, and after that comes whatever else I thought needed to happen. But having range officers that are able to keep a safe range but at the same time keep customers happy is a real art, because you'll watch a lot of ranges that actually do have range officers on site. Typically, they're very gruff, and the way they approach safety with people is not always the best. You know, to be a good range master, you're a great diplomat, too. Be able to tell somebody that they're not doing something correctly in front of all their friends and not ruffle their feathers or have a, you know, a customer mad at you is definitely a real art. That's why you'll notice that our range officer has the little business cards with little things on them that the person's not doing, that the range master can just kind of nice slide it to him on the shooting bench or on the table, and he can see that, oh, okay, I forgot my shooting glasses, or I don't have my action open when the range is going cold, or, you know, I'm on an area where we're not doing rapid fire. So trying to make sure that everybody follows the rules and still not berate them or belittle them in front of the people that they came with is hard, because, you know, a lot of the shooters are used to ranges that do that, and when the range master approaches them, they already think, okay, this guy's about to give me a hard time in front of my wife or my kids or my family, and they're very surprised when our staff comes up with a smile and just says, hey, man, you know, you need to remember to do this or that. I mean, there's always rules that, you know, you don't get a second shot at to break. There's some that, you know, you can leave right then for doing it. But for the most part, it's just people need a little reminder of not crossing the line when the line's cold, or making sure their glasses or their ear protection is on their kids. And, you know, all of our range masters try to do that in a very positive and good way. It's easy for me to train somebody to be a range officer. However, if they weren't given a good personality by their family and good work values and people skills, then there's nothing I can teach them to fix that by the time they come to us. So they have to have that going in. The range safety part, we can get to them relatively quickly. But trying to grow a company in the shooting industry is difficult, because you know, trying to find knowledgeable personal people in the same person is always going to be a challenge for anybody, no matter where you're at. In our area, since we do have such a wide variety of customers, from retired to even people that aren't even originally from here, and you know, they've done their best to learn English and things like that, that it's a challenge to find people that can handle all of them, you know. So we try to have as many different types of people as we can to accommodate our customers. But you'll find that there's so many people that want to work at a range, and they can't understand why you won't hire them, because they know so much about AR-15s, or they know so much about shotguns, or I'm the best pistol shooter there is, why don't you give me a job? You know, they don't really understand all the other factors that go into trying to run the shooting range. And since it is a larger facility, and for this area, 85 acres, you know, I can't be everywhere all the time to make sure they're putting on the best face for it. So you have to have a lot of trust in your staff that they're going to represent you the way that you want. And I don't know that challenge will ever go away. It gets better with each team member that you add. That's great, but at the same time, we're constantly growing. So it'll be quite some time before that challenge is cut down for us.
Going back to one of the things that you were saying, I mean, obviously there's going to be different things that occur with the customers, but I'm sure that the most common things are going to be, you know, hey, you forgot your eye protection, or hey, don't go over the line. I personally remember a time when the line was hot and somebody just grabbed their target frame and unlinked the chain and just began to walk out, right? I mean, in front, try to walk out in front of a hot line and everybody's yelling and screaming, stop, stop, stop. You know, what are some of the, so I guess I should be asking you not what the common ones are, but what are some of the more memorable blunders or safety things that, God forbid, didn't end in tragedy that you may have seen that may or may not be funny, scary, entertaining, or all three?
Well, fortunately, there hasn't been that many of them because fortunately, most shooters are the most responsible of people and the most polite. So out of, 10,000 people or so that have been to our range over the last year or so, there's only two or three we've asked not to come back. And, even Walmart probably has much worse odds than that. So that's pretty good. But you do have a few that every once in a while that don't get it. That's why the range master is just so important. Is that you do get the ones like that they're thinking that they want to shoot and they're just going to walk out there and they're just not really grasping the concept. So you do have a few of those. You'll occasionally have one that will like somebody else's target better than his and start shooting it, and you got to figure out who's doing that and rein them back in. We've had people bring the strangest things to shoot at for targets. They'll bring a propane cylinder out there that's full and think they're going to put it down range and shoot at it, want to see what happens. I mean, if you didn't have a range master there, there is absolutely no telling what people would come up with. And a lot of that has to do with, since we do have this new demographic of shooters that are learning on their own versus in past years, you were almost always taught by somebody else, like we were talking about, that gave you the do's and don'ts of shooting. Now you have people that have just watched TV. They went out and bought their first gun, and they're just going to do whatever they saw on TV. They had no mentor for shooting. So our range masters, all of them, are also instructors. They're the mentors so that they can try to teach everybody the right way to do it. And, one of the ranges that was not far from us, behind that range were some high-voltage power cables for the power company, and mixed in with those were some fiber-optic cables. And somebody on that range sat there all day long shooting so they could finally hit one of those cables for fun. And that cost that range, I think, $75,000 for that little incident, and it happened twice. So it's just amazing what some of these people will do and not think that there's anything wrong with it. We've had people put their gun that they just bought at a gun show that wasn't sure if it worked well or not, so they would lay it on the table and tie a string to the trigger, and they were going to pull the trigger with a string to see how the gun did. And fortunately we have a range master there that stops this stuff from happening and shows people the correct way to do things and not do it that way. So you do, just when you think you've seen the weirdest or the dumbest thing that somebody's done, somebody else will come up with it. When they set out for the shooting range, sometimes they they've watched too many movies before they've come or something and really have these false, perceptions of what a firearm can or can't do, which makes that range master job pretty challenging sometimes, and the indoor ranges, I've watched people get bored shooting their targets. They start shooting the empties on the floor. They try to see if they could ricochet one up to knock out a light. We have a gunsmith shop inside of an indoor gun range that we rent space from for the shop, and we're often in that range testing the firearms that we're working on. And the things that you'll see people do are just absolutely incredible. They'll shoot the target hangers to try to get the target to move so they have a moving target. I mean, things that the average shooter that was mentored by somebody else would never even think of doing, some people think that's just wildly entertaining.
Yeah, it sounds pretty incredible. It's interesting to see, you know. But I think that a lot of that potentially can be attributed to that very thing, is that, you know, we have a whole new generation of people getting interested in firearms, and either they've learned everything they know from TV or Hollywood. Thankfully, with sites like AR15.com, they do have a resource to go through, to get actual educational information, and trying to learn, you know, the proper techniques, proper gun safety and gun handling and all that. But again, one of the biggest challenges with any medium of communication is that there is a lot of crap out there that you have to cut through. There's, you know, very few, you know, websites out there like AR15.com that will be able to provide people with a very good resource and very knowledgeable people. You know, of course, on anything, you know, you have to be able to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff. But that's one of the things that we see all the time being in the industry on the sales end of it. I mean, we see people coming in all the time. You know, a whole new generation of kids is coming in with their parents. Your dad's looking to buy a gun, and the kid's asking me 20 questions. Hey, is this that? Is it that? I saw it in my video game. What's this? What's that? So there's a lot of that sort of ignorance out there floating around that I'm sure you're witness to firsthand on a regular basis.
Yeah, it is. It, you know, and the good thing about AR15.com, too, as a forum, there is not just to boost your forum up, but the thing is that the shooter that buys an AR-15, that's not typically a cheap firearm. It's a little more money than other things they could choose. It's a little more higher end or a better quality gun. The people that invest that money into that platform take the shooting sport a lot more serious than somebody that went out and bought a $79 gun because they didn't know any better. So typically, you know, members of your forum are already taking this shooting sport a lot more serious, and they tend to be much better at the range than somebody that just went and bought, you know, found the cheapest gun they could buy or bought it from the neighbor and went out to go shooting. So when you get to a forum like yours here, you do have a lot more very well thought out and very knowledgeable forum members that give a lot of advice that's great. I mean, you always get occasionally people that are a little out there, but for the most part, you have great people on here that give really, really good advice that they might not be able to get just anywhere depending on where they live. So that goes a long way, because when people start to go shooting or think about shooting, they don't keep that to themselves. They usually share that with everybody, and it's kind of like when you're going to have a baby. Everybody in the world's got advice for you. You know, same thing with shooting. You know, everybody knows better about everything. But, you know, you get on this forum and you start asking questions. It only takes a few minutes to get people that really know what they're doing to post up and answer them for you, which is, you know, something people didn't need to have before. So it's really great to have that, especially with so many new people getting out there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And we're just getting ready. We got a few more minutes left in the show. Let me ask you, Jeff, what's your personal favorite thing to do out there? What do you really enjoy out there, and when you get to go shoot on your time off?
Oh, well, you know, that's really hard, being that I love so many of them. I love shooting the clays. That is addictive because they are interactive. It's a moving target that blows to a million pieces when you're on your mark, and that really tests the skill level. We're starting our IDPA shoots fairly soon, and a lot of our training is going to be towards that, and a lot of our practice time. We built a whole separate range just for IDPA and IPSC and three-gun matches, so that in a way is even taking over my clays a little bit, because we have so many people that are wanting to learn that type of shooting to really better their defensive skills. So I really get a lot out of watching people get better and enjoy it. So you know, it's definitely a toss up for me. I do like the action of both of them, but you know, clay shooting is very addictive, and you know, it's one of those things where, you know, no matter how good you are, you know, you're rarely going to be perfect all the time. I know very few shooters that are. So it one constantly challenges you, almost like golf. So I love that. But I love teaching as well. So teaching people to shoot sometimes is as much fun for me as shooting as well. So it kind of tears me in so many different directions having a facility where I can do everything. You know, it'd probably be easier for me to answer if I only had a facility that did one thing, you know. So I'm definitely torn in many directions as far as my favorite goes.
And finally, what do you see upcoming in the next couple weeks, months, and years for your facility in particular, Okeechobee Shooting Sports at okshooting.com?
Well, we're about to get our permits for a bunch of our other facilities that we're going to put in. So the construction hopefully will be rolling very hard again here, and we'll get a lot of things in place, some more classrooms and things like that done, so we can do a lot more out there. And you know, our facility is going to be forever changing because there's so many dreams that we have of what we want to do with it to make it so enjoyable for so many people. So, you know, I really look forward to the challenge of all the construction projects and getting those things done and starting to have a lot more events and charity shoots and things like that out there. So we're really looking forward to that. And, you know, one of the great things about our location, which is why we chose Okeechobee, besides the fact that they're a very outdoor sports-friendly attitude in their government, is that, you know, we're not far from Orlando or Fort Lauderdale or West Palm Beach, so we're in the middle of millions and millions of people, so it's just great seeing so many of them find a new place to go, and or any place to go for that matter, and they show up with a big smile on their face, just so excited they get to enjoy their sports again. So we look forward to going to work every day out there because of so many great things that are going on. So we're really looking forward to the next few years of continued development of the range.
Well, that sounds great. And again, you do attract a clientele that's potentially nationwide and international as well. So for those of you ARFCOMers out there that may not have the joy and benefit and sometimes insanity that is living in South Florida, the destination is open. We just put up, Jeff just put up a link on his website to the Hampton Inn. It's about a mile and a half. It's in a brand new hotel. Again, you can book with Jeff, book with the inn. They'll be happy to take care of you. You know, if you're coming here on vacation, from, you know, taking the kids to Disney World, it's only an hour and a half drive from Orlando. It's not a bad trip at all from most places in Florida. It's only a couple hours. So if you are spending some time on vacation down here, you know, you can check out. You can hook up with your Florida hometown members for shoots. You can meet Jeff out at the range. You can come shooting with me out there. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that's offered there at Okeechobee. So again, it is offered available for nationwide access, and any and all AR15.com members are welcome there. We see plenty of Boltface logo stickers out there on a regular basis, and so it's a very nice place. And if you ARFCOMers out there ever do get down to Florida, man, come out and see us. We'd be happy to take you shooting, and I'm sure Jeff would love to see you and chat with you. And he's also going to be offering, like you said, IDPA IPSC shoots, as well as world-class training for tactical. There's a nice shotgun training event coming up for clay shooting. So whatever it is, I'm sure Jeff would like to see you. And thanks again for the call, Jeff, and we're looking forward to speaking with you whenever you'd like to appear on Radio Free ARFCOM.
Thanks, Ben, and I'm glad you took on the challenge and the responsibility of doing this show, and I think you're going to do great, and I look forward to being here again with you.
Thanks, Jeff. It's always nice talking with you, buddy. We'll catch you later.
All right, take care.
And we're getting down to the wire here on Radio Free ARFCOM. So then we will head to general discussion and Zombie Central. Midgets versus Zeds. How well would the Midgets do? Poll results show 40% of the responders said, I just want to see what a midget zombie looks like. And with that, that is your Radio Free ARFCOM for the evening. My name is Benjamin. It's been a pleasure being your host. If you'd like to contact me, it's FL_flyfishing_guide. You can IM me with comments. I'd be happy to take your calls. And again, if there's anybody out there in ARFCOM radio land, we would love to get some sponsors on and have you on the show. Anybody interested in the show can contact me at any time. And with that, I will leave you to your evenings and have a great rest of your July, and I hope you all had a great Independence Day. And with that, we will be heading out of here. Thanks again, ARFCOM. It was a pleasure. Looking forward to it again next week. This is your Radio Free ARFCOM, signing off.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.